We were 9 men. Suleiman and Khaled decided that we had to leave the camp. There was a cave on another mountain, about 12 hours' march away to the east, which they hoped might give us adequate protection from attack. The Russians were sure to have another helicopter in the air within a few hours at most. Ground forces wouldn't be far behind.
Every man fill 2 canteens with snow and keep them inside his clothes, next to his body on the march, Khaled said to me, translating Suleiman's orders. We carry weapons, ammunition, medicines, blankets, some fuel, some wood, and the goat. Nothing else. Let's go.
We left on the march with empty stomachs, and that state defined us for the next 4 weeks as we hunkered down in the new mountain cave. One of Jalalad's young friends, Hanif, had been a halal butcher in his home village. He slaughtered, skinned, gutted, and quartered the goat when we arrived. We prepared a fire with wood that we'd carried from the ruined camp, and a sprinkle of spirit from one of the lamps. The meat was cooked, every last morsel, except for the parts, such as the legs of the animal below the knee joint, which were regarded as haram, or forbidden for Muslims to eat. The carefully cooked meat was then rationed into small, daily shares. We stored the bulk of the cooked flesh in an improvised refrigerator scooped out of the ice and snow. And then, for 4 weeks, we nibbled at the dry meat and cringed inwardly as hunger twisted us around the craving for more. It was an expression of our discipline and good-natured support for one another that the meat from one goat kept 9 men alive for 4 weeks. We tried many times to slip away from the camp and reach one of the neighbouring khels to secure some extra food. But all the local villages were occupied by enemy troops, and the entire mountain range was surrounded by patrols of Afghan army units led by Russians. Habib's torches had combined with the damage we'd done to the helicopters to rouse a furious determination in the Russians and Afghan regulars. On one foraging mission, our scouts heard an announcement echoing through the nearest valley. The Russians had attached a loudspeaker to a military jeep. An Afghan, speaking in Pashto, described us as bandits and criminals and said that a special task force had been set up to capture us. They'd put a reward on our heads. Our scouts wanted to shoot at the vehicle, but they thought it might be a trap designed to draw us out of hiding. They let it pass, and the words of the hunters echoed in the sheer stone canyons like the howl of prowling wolves. Apparently acting on false information, or perhaps following the trail of Habib's bloody executions, the Russians, working from all the surrounding villages, concentrated their searches on another mountain range to the north of us. For so long as we remained in our remote cave, we seemed to be safe. So we waited, trapped and hungering and afraid, through the 4 coldest weeks of the year. We hid, creeping through shadows in the daylight hours, and huddled together without light or heat in the darkness every night. And slowly, one ice-edged hour at a time, the knife of war whittled the wishing and hoping away, until all that was left to us, within the hard, disconsolate wrap of our own arms around our own shivering bodies, was the lonely will to survive. Chapter 36. I couldn't face the loss of Kadarbai, my father dream. I'd helped to bury him, for God's sake, with my own hands. But I didn't grieve, and I didn't mourn him. There wasn't enough truth in me for that kind of sorrowing, because my heart wouldn't believe him dead. I'd loved him too much, it seemed to me in that winter of war, for him to simply be gone, to be dead. If so much love could vanish into the earth and speak no more, smile no more, then love was nothing. And I wouldn't believe that. I was sure there had to be a payoff, somehow, and I kept waiting for it. I didn't know then, as I do now, that love's a one-way street. Love, like respect, isn't something you get. It's something you give. But not knowing that in those bitter weeks, not thinking that, I turned from the hole in my life where so much loving hope had been, and I refused to feel the longing or the loss. I cringed within the bleak, concealing camouflage of snow and shadowed stone. I chewed the leathered fragments of goat's meat left to us, and each minute crammed with heartbeats and hunger dragged me further from the grieving and the truth. Eventually, of course, we exhausted the supply of meat, and a meeting was called to discuss our options. Jalalud and the younger Afghans wanted to make a run for it, to fight our way through enemy lines and strike out for the desert region of Zabul province, close to the Pakistan border. Suleiman and Khaled reluctantly agreed that there was no other option, but they wanted clear intelligence of the enemy disposition before choosing where to launch a breakout attack. To that end, Suleiman sent young Hanif on a scouting mission that would take him on a sweeping curve from the southwest to the north and southeast of our position. He ordered the young man to return within 24 hours and to travel only at night. It was a long, cold, hungry wait for Hanif to return. We were drinking water, but that only staved off the torment for a few minutes and left us even hungrier. 24 hours stretched to 2 days, and then into a third, with no sign of him. On the morning of the third day, we accepted that Hanif was dead or captured. Juma, a cameleer from the tiny Tajik enclave in the southwest of Afghanistan near Iran, volunteered to search for him. He was a dark, thin-faced man, with a hawk-like nose and a thickly emotive mouth. He was close to Hanif and Jalalud, the closeness that men in wars and prisons find, against their every expectation, and rarely express in words or gestures. Juma's Tajik clans of cameleers were traditional rivals of the Momand Hazabur's people of Hanif and Jalalud in the nomadic transport of trade goods. The competition between the groups had become intense as Afghanistan rapidly modernized. In 1920, fully one in every three Afghans was a nomad. Just two generations later, by 1970, only 2% of the people were nomads. Rivals though they were, the three young men had been thrown into close cooperation with one another by the war, and they'd become inseparable friends. Their friendship had developed in the insidiously dull months that troughed between the peaks of fighting, and was tested many times in combat. In their most successful battle, they'd used landmines and grenades to destroy a Russian tank. Each of them wore, on a leather thong around his neck, a small piece of metal taken from the tank as a souvenir. When Juma declared that he would search for Hanif, we all knew that we couldn't prevent him from doing it. With a weary sigh, Suleiman agreed to let him go. Refusing to wait until nightfall, Juma shouldered his weapon and crept from the camp at once. He'd gone without food for 3 days, just as we had. But the smile that he sent back to Jalalud, as he looked over his shoulder for the last time, was bright with strength and courage. We watched him leave, watched his thin, retreating shadow sweep the sundial of the snowy slopes beneath us. Hunger exaggerated the cold. It was a long, hard winter, with snow falling on the mountains around us every other day. The temperature fluttered above zero during the daylight hours, but sank into icy, teeth-chattering sub-zero levels from dusk until well after dawn. My hands and feet were constantly cold, achingly cold. The skin on my face was wooden and as riven with cracks as the feet of the farmers in Prabhakar's village. We pissed on our hands to fight off the aching sting of the cold, and it helped to bring feeling back to them momentarily. But we were so cold that taking a piss was a serious issue. First there was the dread inspired by having to open our clothes at all, and then there was the chill that followed the release of a bladder of warm fluid. Losing that warmth caused the body temperature to drop quickly, and we always put it off until the last moment. Juma failed to return that night. At midnight, with hunger and fear prodding us awake, we all jumped at a little crickle of sound in the darkness. 7 guns aimed at the spot. Then we gasped as a face loomed from the shadows, much closer than we'd expected. It was Habib.
"What are you doing, my brother?"
Khaled asked him gently, in Urdu.
"You gave us a big fright."
"They are here,"
he answered, in a rational, calm voice that seemed to rise from another mind or another place, as if he was a medium speaking in a trance. His face was filthy. We were all unwashed and bearded, but Habib's filth was something so repulsive and thickly smeared that it was shocking. Like poison pouring from an infected wound, the foulness seemed to squeeze outward through the pores of his skin from some feculence deep within.
"They are everywhere, all around you. And they are coming up here to get you, to kill you all, when more men come. Tomorrow, or the day after that. Soon. They know where you are. They will kill you all. There is only one way out of here now."
"How did you find us here, brother?" Khaled asked, his voice as calm and remote as Habib's.
"I came with you. I have always been near you. Did you not see me?"
"My friends," Jalalat asked, "Juma and Hanif, did you see them anywhere?" Habib didn't reply. Jalalad asked the question again, more forcefully.
"Did you see them? Were they in the Russian camp? Were they captured?"
We listened in a silence thick with our fear and the poisonous smells of decayed flesh that clung to Habib. He seemed to be meditating, or perhaps listening to something no one else could hear.
"Tell me, Bachi Kaka," Suleiman asked gently, using the familiar term for nephew. "What did you mean, there is only one way out of here now?"
"They are everywhere,"
Habib answered, his face deformed by its wide-mouthed, psychotic stare. Mahmoud Melbaf was translating for me, whispering close to my ear.
"They don't have enough men. They have mined all the easiest ways out of the mountains. The north, the east, the west, all mined. Only the southeast is clear, because they think you will not try to escape that way. They left that way clear, so they can come up here to get you. We can't go out that way,"
Mahmoud whispered to me when Habib stopped suddenly.
"The Russians, they hold the valley southeast of here. It is their way to Kandahar. When they come for us, they will come from that direction. If we go that way, we will all die, and they know it. Now they are in the southeast, but for tomorrow, for one day, they are all on the far side of the mountain, in the northwest,"
Habib said. His voice was still calm and composed, but his face was a gargoyle's leer, and the contrast unnerved us all.
"Only a few of them stay here tomorrow. Only a few will stay, while the rest of them put the last mines on the northwest slopes just after dawn. If you run at them, attack them, fight them tomorrow, in the southeast, there will only be a few of them. You can break through and escape, but only tomorrow."
"How many are they altogether?"
Jalalad asked.
68 men. They have mortars, rockets, and 6 heavy machine guns. There are too many of them for you to sneak past them at night."
"But you sneaked past them,"
Jalalad insisted defiantly.
"They cannot see me," Habib replied serenely. "I am invisible to them. They cannot see me until I am pushing my knife into their throats.
That's ridiculous, Jalalad hissed at him. They are soldiers. You are a soldier. If you can get past them, we can do it.
Did your men return to you? Habib asked him,
turning his maniac stare on the young fighter for the first time. Jalalad opened his mouth to speak, but the words sank into the small heaving sea of his heart. He cast his eyes down and shook his head.
Could you enter this camp without being seen or heard, as I did? If you try to get past them, you will die, like your friends. You cannot get past them. I can do it, but you cannot.
But you think we can fight our way out of here?
Khaled put the question to him gently, quietly, but we all heard the urgency in it.
You can. It is the only way. I have been everywhere on this mountain, and I have been so close to them that I can hear them scratch their skin. That is the reason why I am here. I came to tell you how to save yourselves. But there is a price for my help. All the ones you do not kill tomorrow, the ones who survive, they will be mine. You will give them to me.
Yes, yes, Suleiman agreed soothingly. Come, Bachikaka, tell us what you know. We want to share your knowledge. Sit with us and tell us what you know. We have no food, so we cannot offer you a meal. I'm sorry.
There is food,
Habib interrupted, pointing beyond us to the shadows at the edge of our camp.
I smell food there.
True enough, the rotting pieces of the dead goat, the haram cuts from the animal, lay in a little heap in the slushy snow. Cold as it was, and even in the snow, the bits of raw meat had long begun to decay. We couldn't smell them from that distance, but it seemed that Habib could. The madman's comment provoked a long discussion of the religious rights and wrongs of eating haram food. The men weren't rigid in the observation of their faith. They prayed every day, but not in strict adherence to the timetable of 3 sessions, ordained by Shia Islam, or the 5 sessions of the Sunni Muslims. They were good men of faith rather than overtly religious men. Nevertheless, in a time of war, and with the great dangers we faced, the last power they wanted ranged against them was God's. They were holy warriors, mujahideen, men who believed that they would become martyrs at the instant that they died in battle, and that they were assured a place in the heavens where beautiful maidens would attend them. They didn't want to pollute themselves with forbidden foods when they were so close to the martyrs' rush for paradise. It was a tribute to their faith, in fact, that the mere discussion of the haram meat hadn't occurred until we'd hungered for a month and then starved for 5 days. For my part, I confessed to Mahmoud Melbath that I'd been thinking about the discarded meat almost constantly for the last few days. I wasn't a Muslim, and the meat wasn't forbidden to me. But I'd lived so closely with the fighters, and for so many painful weeks, that I'd linked my fate to theirs. I would never have eaten anything while they hungered. I wanted to eat the meat, but only if they agreed and ate it with me. Suleiman delivered the decisive opinion on the matter. He reminded the men that while it was indeed evil for a Muslim to eat haram food, it was an even greater evil for a Muslim to starve himself to death when haram food was available to be eaten. The men decided that we would cook the rotting meat in a soup before the first light. Then, fortified by that meal, we would use Habib's information on the enemy positions to fight our way out of the mountains. During the long weeks of hiding and waiting without heat or hot food, we'd entertained and supported one another with the stories we'd told. On that last night, after several others had spoken, it was my turn once more. For my first story, weeks before, I'd told them about my escape from prison. Although they'd been scandalized by my admissions about being a guna or sinner and being imprisoned as a criminal, they'd been thrilled by the account and asked many questions afterwards. My second story had been about the night of the assassins, how Abdullah, Vikram and I had tracked the Nigerian killers down, how we'd fought with them, defeated them, and then expelled them from the country, how I'd hunted Maurizio, the man who'd caused it all, and beat him with my fists, and how I'd wanted to kill him, but had spared his life, only to regret that pity when he'd attacked Lisa Carter and forced Ulla to kill him. That story, too, had been very well received, and as Mahmoud Melbaf took his place beside me to translate my third story, I wondered what might capture their enthusiasm anew. My mind scanned its list of heroes. There were many, so many men and women, beginning with my own mother, whose courage and sacrifice inspired the memory of them. But when I began to speak, I found myself telling Prabhakar's story. The words, like some kind of desperate prayer, came unbidden from my heart. I told them how Prabhakar had left his village Eden for the city when he was still a child, how he'd returned as a teenager with the wild street boy Raju and other friends to confront the menace of the dacoits, how Rukmabai, Prabhakar's mother, had put courage into the men of the village, how young Raju had fired his revolver as he walked toward the boastful leader of the dacoits until the man fell dead, how Prabhakar had loved feasting and dancing and music, how he'd saved the woman he loved from the cholera epidemic and married her, and how he'd died in a hospital bed, surrounded by our sorrowing love. After Mahmoud finished translating the last of my words, there was a lengthy silence while they considered the tale. I was just convincing myself that they were as moved by the life of my little friend as I was myself, when the first questions began.
"So, how many goats did they have in that village?" Suleiman asked gravely. "He wants to know how many goats," Mahmoud began translating.
I got it, I smiled. "Well, near as I can tell, about 80, maybe as many as 100. Each household has about 2 or 3 goats, but some had as many as 6 or 8. That information inspired a little gesticulating buzz of discussion that was more animated and partisan than any of the political or religious debates that had occasionally stirred among the men.
"What colour were these goats?" Jalalad asked. "The colours," Mahmoud explained solemnly. "He wants to know the colours of those goats."
"Well, gee, they were brown, I guess, and white, and a few black ones."
"Were they big goats, like the ones in Iran?" Mahmoud translated for Suleiman. "Or were they skinny, like the ones in Pakistan?"
"Well, about so big," I suggested, gesturing with my hands.
"How much milk?"
Nazir asked, caught up in the discussion in spite of himself.
"Did they get from those goats every day?"
"I'm not really an expert on goats."
"Try," Nazir insisted. "Try to remember."
"Oh, shit. It's just a wild stab in the dark, mind you, but I'd say maybe a couple of liters a day," I offered, raising the palms of my hands helplessly.
"This friend of yours, how much did he earn as a taxi driver?" Suleiman asked. "Did this friend go out with a woman, alone, before his marriage?"
Jalalad wanted to know, causing all the men to laugh and some of them to throw small stones at him. In that way, the session moved through all the themes that concerned them, until at last I excused myself and found a relatively sheltered spot where I could stare at the misty nothing of the frozen, shrouded sky. I was trying to fight down the fear that prowled in my empty belly and leapt up with sharp claws at my heart in its cage of ribs. tomorrow. We were going to fight our way out. No one had said it, but I knew that all the others were thinking we would die. They were too cheerful, too relaxed. All the tension and dread of the last weeks had drained from them once we'd made the decision to fight. It wasn't the joyful relief of men who know they're saved. It was something else. Something I'd seen in the mirror in my cell on the night before my desperate escape from prison, and something I'd seen in the eyes of the man who'd escaped with me. It was the exhilaration of men who were risking everything, risking life and death, on one throw of the dice. Sometime on the next day, we would be free, or we would be dead. The same resolution that had sent me over the front wall of a prison was sending us over the ridge and into the enemy guns. It's better to die fighting than to die like a rat in a trap. I'd escaped from prison and crossed the world and crossed the years to find myself in the company of men who felt exactly as I did about freedom and death. And still I was afraid, afraid of being wounded, afraid of being shot in the spine and paralyzed, afraid of being captured alive and tortured in another prison by yet another prison guard. It occurred to me that Carla and Kaderbai would have had something clever to say to me about fear. And in thinking that, I realized how remote they were from the moment and the mountain and me. I realized that I didn't need their brilliance anymore. It couldn't help me. All the cleverness in all the world couldn't stop my stomach from knotting around its prowling fear. When you know you're going to die, there's no comfort in cleverness. Genius is vain, and cleverness is hollow at the end. The comfort that does come, if it comes at all, is that strangely marbled mix of time and place and feeling that we usually call wisdom. For me, on that last night before the battle, it was the sound of my mother's voice, and it was the life and death of my friend, Prabhaka. God give you rest, Prabhaka. I still love you, and the grieving, when I think of you, is pinned to my heart and my eyes with bright and burning stars. My comfort on that freezing ridge was the memory of Prabhaka's smiling face and the sound of my mother's voice. Whatever you do in life, do it with courage, and you won't go far wrong.
Here,
take one, Khaled said, sliding down beside me to squat on his heels, and offering me one of two half cigarettes that he held in his bare hand.
Jesus, I gawked. Where'd you get those? I thought we all ran out last week.
We did,
he said, lighting the cigarettes with a small gas lighter.
Except for these. I kept them for a special occasion. I think this is it. I got a bad feeling, Lynn. A real bad feeling. It's inside me, and I can't shake it tonight.
It was the first time that we'd spoken more than the essential word or two since the night that Kader had left. We'd worked and slept side by side every day and night, but I almost never met his eye, and I'd avoided conversation with him so coldly that he, too, had been silent with me.
Look, Khaled, about Kader and Carla, don't feel... I mean, I'm not...
No, he interrupted. You had plenty of reason to be mad. I can see it from your side. I always could. You got a raw deal, and I told Kader that, too, on the night he left. He should have trusted you. It's a funny thing. The guy he trusted most, the only guy in the whole world he really trusted all the way, turned out to be a crazy killer, and the one who sold us all out.
The New York accent, with its Arabic swell, rolled over me like a warm, frothy wave, and I almost reached out to hug him. I'd missed the assurances I'd always found in the sound of that voice, and the honest suffering I saw in the scarred face. I was so glad to have his friendship again that I confused what he'd said about Kader Bai. I thought, without really thinking at all, that he was talking about Abdullah. He wasn't. And that, too, like 100 other chances to know all the truth in the one conversation, was lost. "How well did you know Abdullah?" I asked him.
"Pretty well," he answered,
his little smile becoming an asking frown. "Where is this going?"
"Did you like him?" "Not really."
"Why not?"
"Abdullah didn't believe in anything. He was a rebel without a cause, in a world that doesn't have enough rebels for the real causes. I don't like, and I don't really trust, people who don't believe in anything."
"Does that include me?"
"No," he laughed. "You believe in a lot of things. That's why I like you. That's why Kader loved you. He did love you, you know. He told me so, a couple different times."
"What do I believe in?" I scoffed.
"You believe in people," he replied quickly. "That stuff with the slum clinic and all. The story you told the guys tonight, that about the village. You'd forget that shit if you didn't believe in people. That work in the slum, when the cholera went through the place. Kader loved that, what you did then. And so did I. Shit, for a while there, I think you even had Carla believing too. You gotta understand, Lynn. If Kader had a choice, if there was a better way to do what he had to do, he would have taken it. It all played out the way it had to. Nobody wanted to fuck you over."
"Not even Carla," I smiled, savoring the last puff of the cigarette and then stubbing it out on the ground.
"Well, maybe Carla," he conceded, laughing the small, sad laugh. "But that's Carla. I think the only guy she never fucked over was Abdullah."
"Were they together?" I asked, so surprised that I couldn't help the pinch of jealousy that pulled my brows together in a hard little frown.
"Well, you couldn't say together," he answered evenly, staring into my eyes. "But I was, once. I used to live with her."
"You what?"
"I lived with her for 6 months."
"What happened?" I asked, gritting my teeth and feeling stupid for it. I had no right to be angry or jealous. I'd never asked Carla about her lovers, and she'd never asked me about mine.
"You don't know, do you?"
"I wouldn't ask if I knew."
"She dumped me," he said slowly, "just about the time you came along."
"Oh, fuck, man."
"It's okay," he smiled.
We were silent for a moment, both of us reeling back through the years. I remembered Abdullah at the sea wall near the Haji Ali Mosque on the night that I met him with Kader Bai. I remembered him saying that a woman had taught him the clever phrase he'd used in English. It must have been Carla. Of course it was Carla. And I remembered the stiffness that was in Khaled's manner when I first met him. And I realized, suddenly, that he must have been hurting then, and maybe blaming me for it. I saw clearly what it must have taken for him to be as friendly and kind to me as he was at the beginning.
"You know," he added after a while, "you really got to go careful with Carla Lynn. She's angry, you know? And she's hurt.
She's hurt bad, in all the places that count. They really fucked her up when she was a kid. She's a bit crazy. She did something in the States before she came to India, and that fucked her up too.
What did she do?
I don't know. Something pretty serious. She never told me what it was. We talked around it, if you get my meaning. I think Kader Bhai knew about it because, you know, he was the first one to meet her.
No, I didn't know that, I answered him, frowning with the thought of how little I knew about the woman I'd loved for so long. Why do you think she never told me about Kader Bhai? I knew her a long time, when we were both working for him, and she didn't say a word. I talked about him, but she never said a word. She didn't mention his name once.
I think she's just loyal to him, you know? I don't think there's anything against you, Lynn. She's just incredibly loyal. Well, she was incredibly loyal to him. She thought of him like a father, I think. Her own father died when she was a kid, and her stepfather died when she was still pretty young. Kader came along just in time to save her, so he got to be her father.
You said he was the first one who met her?
Yeah, on a plane. It's kind of a weird story, the way she told me. She didn't remember getting on the plane. She was running from something she did, and she was in trouble. She ended up going on a few different planes from different airports, for a few days, I think. And then she was on this plane that was going to Singapore from, I don't know, somewhere. And she must have had, like, a nervous breakdown or something, because she cracked up. And the next thing she knew, she was in this cave in India, with Kader Bhai. And then he left her with Ahmed, who looked after her.
She told me about him.
Did she? She doesn't talk about it much. She liked that guy. He nursed her for near about 6 months, until she got herself together again. He brought her back, into the light, like. They were pretty close. I think he was the closest thing to a brother she ever knew.
Were you with her? I mean, did you know her then, when he was killed?
I don't know that he was killed, Lynn,
Khaled stated, frowning hard as the knot of recollections turned in his memory.
I know Carla believes it, that Madame Jo killed him and the girl.
Christine.
Yeah, Christine. But I knew Ahmed pretty well. He was a very gentle guy, a very simple, soft kind of a guy. He was just the type to take poison with his girlfriend, like in a romantic movie, if he thought he couldn't ever be free with her. Kader looked into it real close, because Ahmed was one of his guys, and he was sure Jo had nothing to do with it. He cleared her.
But Carla wouldn't accept it?
No, she didn't buy it. And coming on top of everything else, it really fucked her up. Did she ever tell you she loves you?
I hesitated, partly from reluctance to surrender the little advantage I might have had over him if he believed that she did say it, and partly from loyalty to Carla, because it was her business after all. In the end, I answered him. I had to know why he'd asked me the question. No.
That's too bad, he said flatly. I thought you might be the one.
The one?
The one to help her. To break through, I guess. Something really bad happened to that girl. A lot of bad things happened to her. Kader made it worse, I think.
How?
he put her to work for him. He saved her when he met her, and he protected her from what she was scared of back in the States. But then she met this guy, a politician, and he fell for her pretty hard. Kader needed the guy, so he got her to work for him. And I don't think she was cut out for it.
What kind of work?
You know how beautiful she is. Those green eyes and that white skin.
Ah, fuck, I sighed, remembering a lecture Kader had given me once about the amount of crime in the sin and the sin in the crime.
I don't know what was in Kader's head,
Khaled concluded, shaking his own head in doubt and wonder.
It was out of character, to say the least. I honestly don't think he saw it as damaging her. But she kind of froze up inside. It was like her own father was getting her to do that shit. And I don't think she forgave him for it. But she was incredibly loyal to him all the same. I never understood it. But that's how I got together with her. I saw all that happening, and I felt kind of sorry for her, if you know what I mean. After a while, one thing led to another. But I never really got through to her. And you didn't, neither. I don't think anyone will. Ever.
Ever is a long time.
Okay, you got a point. But I'm just trying to warn you. I don't want you to get hurt anymore, brother. We've been through too much, nah? And I don't want her to get hurt.
He fell silent again. We stared at the rocks and the frosty ground, avoiding one another's eyes. A few shivering minutes passed. At last he took a deep breath and stood up, slapping at the chill in his arms and legs. I stood as well, trembling with cold and stamping my numb feet. At the last possible moment, and with an impulsive rush, as if he was breaking through a tangle of vines, Khaled flung his arms around me and hugged me. The strength in his arms was fierce, but his head slowly came to rest against mine as tenderly as the lolling head of a sleeping child. When he pulled away from me, his face was averted, and I couldn't see his eyes. He walked off, and I followed more slowly, hugging my hands under my arms to fight off the cold. It was only when I was alone that I recalled what he'd said to me. I got a bad feeling, Lynn. A real bad feeling. I resolved to talk to him about it, but just at that moment, Habib stepped out of a shadow beside me, and I jumped in fright. "For fuck's sake," I hissed. "You scared the fucking shit out of me. Don't do that shit, Habib."
"It's okay. It's okay," Mahmoud Melbaf said, stepping up beside the madman.
Habib garbled something at me, speaking so quickly that I couldn't make out a single clear syllable. His eyes were starting from his head. The effect was exaggerated by the dark, heavy pouches beneath his eyes, which dragged the lower lids with them and showed too much white below the fractured, scattered wheel of the iris.
"What?" "It's okay," Mahmoud repeated. "He wants to talk with everybody. He talks to every man tonight. He comes to me. He asks me to make it English for you, what he says. You are the last, before Khaled. He wants to speak to Khaled last."
"What did he say?" Mahmoud asked him to repeat what he'd said to me. Habib did speak again, in exactly the same too rapid, hyper-energetic manner, staring into my eyes as if he expected an enemy or a monstrous beast to emerge from them. I was just as steadfast in returning the stare. I'd been locked up with violent, crazy men, and I knew better than to take my eyes off him.
"He says that strong men make the luck to happen," Mahmoud translated for us.
What?
Strong men, they make it for itself, the luck. Strong men make their own luck, is that what he means?
Yes, exactly so, Mahmud agreed.
A strong man can make his own luck.
What does he mean?
I do not know, Mahmud replied, smiling patiently. He just says it.
He's just going around telling everybody this, I asked, that a strong man makes his own luck.
No. For me, he said that the Prophet, peace be upon him, was a great soldier before he was a great teacher. For Jalalat, he said that the stars shine because they are full with secrets. It is different for every man. And he was in too much a hurry for telling us these things. It is very important for him. I do not understand, Lin. I think it is because we fight tomorrow morning.
Was there anything else? I asked, mystified by the exchange.
Mahmud asked Habib if there was anything else that he wanted to say. Holding the stare into my eyes, Habib rattled away in Pashto and Farsi.
He says only that there is no such a thing as luck. He wants you to believe him. He says again that a strong man makes his own luck.
I completed the translation for him. Well, tell him I appreciate the message. Mahmud spoke, and for a few moments Habib stared harder, searching in my eyes for a recognition or response that I couldn't give him. He turned and loped away with the stooped, crouching run that I found more chilling and alarming somehow than the more obvious bulging madness in his eyes.
Now what's he up to? I asked Mahmud, relieved that he was gone.
He will find Khalid, I think, Mahmud replied.
Damn, it's cold, I spluttered.
Yes, I am too cold, like you. I am all day dreaming that this cold will be gone.
Mahmud, you were in Bombay when we went to hear the blind singers with Kader Bhai, weren't you?
Yes. It was the first meeting for all of us, at the same time, together. I saw you there the first time.
I'm sorry, I didn't meet you that night, and I didn't notice you there. What I wanted to ask you is how you got together with Kader Bhai in the first place.
Mahmud laughed. It was so rare to see him laugh out loud that I felt myself smiling in response. He'd lost weight on the mission. We'd all lost weight. His face was drawn tight to the high cheekbones and the pointed chin. Covered with a thick, dark beard. His eyes, even in the cold moonlight, were the polished bronze of a temple vase.
I am standing on the street in Bombay, and I am doing some passport business with my friend. There is a hand on my shoulder. It is Abdullah. He tells me that Kader Khan wants to see me. I go to Kader in his car. We drive together. We talk, and after, I am his man.
Why did he pick you? What made him pick you? And what made you agree to join him?
Mahmud frowned, and it seemed that he might be considering the question for the first time.
I was against Pahlavi Shah, he began. The secret police of the Shah, the Savak, they killed many people. And they put many people in the jail for beating. My father killed in the jail. My mother killed in the jail. For fighting against Shah. I was a small boy that time. When I grow up, I fight Shah. 2 times in the jail. 2 times beating. And electricity on my body. And too much pain. I fight for revolution in Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini makes the revolution in Iran. And he is the new power when Shah runs away to America. But Savak secret police still the same. Now they work for Khomeini. Again I go in the jail. Again the beating and the electric pain. The same people from the Shah. The exactly same people in the jail. Now they work for Khomeini. All my friends die in the jail. And in the war against Iraq. I escape.
and come to Bombay. I make business, black market business, with other Iran people. Then, Abdelkader Khan makes me his man. In my life, I meet only one great man. That is Kader. Now he is dead.
He choked off the words and rubbed a tear from each eye with the sleeve of his rough jacket. It was a long speech, and we were freezing cold, yet still I would have asked him more. I wanted to know it all. Everything that filled the gaps between what Kader Bhai had told me and the secrets Khalid had shared. But at that moment we heard a piercingly piteous scream of terror. It died suddenly, as if the thread of sound had been cut with a pair of shears. We looked at one another and reached for weapons in the same instinct.
"This way!"
Mahmud shouted, running over the slippery snow and slush with short, careful steps. We reached the origin of the sound at the same time as the other men. Nazir and Suleiman rushed through our group to see what we were staring at. They froze, silent and still, at the sight of Khaled Ansari kneeling over the body of Habib Abdurrahman. The madman was on his back. He was dead. There was a knife in his throat, where the words about luck had been only minutes before. The knife had been pushed into his neck and twisted, just as Habib himself had done to our horses and to Siddiqui. But it wasn't Habib's knife that we stared at, jutting out of the muddy, sinewed throat like a branch from a riverbed. We all knew the knife well. We'd all seen its distinctive carved horn handle 100 times. It was Khaled's knife. Nazir and Suleiman put their hands under Khaled's arms and lifted him gently from the corpse. He accepted the help momentarily, but then he shrugged them off and knelt beside the body. Habib's patu shawl was rucked up around his chest. Khaled pulled something from the front of the dead man's flak jacket. It was metal. 2 pieces of metal, hanging from Habib's neck on leather thongs. Jalalad rushed forward and snatched them. They were the souvenir fragments of the tank that he and Hanif and Juma had destroyed. The pieces that his friends had worn around their necks. Khaled stood and turned and walked slowly away from the killing. I put my hand on his shoulder as he passed me and walked with him. Behind me there was a howl of rage as Jalalad attacked Habib's corpse with the butt of his Kalashnikov. I looked over my shoulder to see the mad eyes of the lunatic crushed beneath the rise and smashing fall of the weapon. And in one of those perversities of the pitying heart, I found myself feeling sorry for Habib. I'd wanted to kill him myself more than once, and I knew that I was glad he was dead. But my heart was so sorry for him in that moment that I grieved as if he was a friend. He was a teacher, I heard myself thinking. The most violent and dangerous man I'd ever known had been a kindergarten teacher. I couldn't shake that thought, as if it was the only truth in that moment that really mattered. And when the men finally dragged Jalalad away, there was nothing left. Nothing but blood and snow and hair and shattered bone, where the life and the tortured mind had been. Khaled returned to our cave. He was muttering something in Arabic. His eyes were radiant, filled with a vision that illuminated him and put an almost frightening resolve into the set of his scarred features. At the cave, he removed the belt around his waist that held his canteen. He let it slip to the ground. He lifted the cartridge belt over his head from his shoulder and let that too fall. Next, he rummaged through his pockets, emptying them of their contents one by one, until there was nothing on him but the clothes he wore. At his feet were his false passports, his money, his letters, his wallet, his weapons, his jewelry, and even the bruised, wrinkle-eared photos of his long-dead family. "What's he saying?" I asked Mahmud desperately. I'd spent the last 4 weeks avoiding Khaled's eye and coldly rejecting his friendship.
Suddenly, I was unbearably afraid that I was going to lose him, that I'd already lost him.
It is the Quran, Mahmud replied in a whisper. He is telling surahs from the Quran.
Khalid left the cave and walked to the edge of the compound. I ran to stop him and pushed him back with both hands. He allowed the shove and then came on toward me again. I threw my arms around him and dragged him back a few paces. He didn't resist me. He stared directly ahead at that infuriating vision only he could see, while he chanted the hypnotically poetic verses of the Quran. And when I let him go, he continued his walk out of the camp.
Help me, I shouted. Can't you see? He's going. He's going out there.
Mahmud, Nazir, and Suleiman came forward, but instead of helping me to restrain Khalid, they grasped my arms and gently prized them away from him. Khalid immediately began to walk forward. I wrestled myself free and rushed to stop him again. I shouted at him and slapped at his face to waken him to the danger. He didn't resist, and he didn't react. I felt the tears hot on my cold face, stinging in the cracks that split my frozen lips. I felt the sobbing in my chest like a river rappling and rolling against worn and rounded rocks, on and on and on. I held him tight, with one arm around his neck and the other around his waist, my hands locked together at his back. Nazir, even as thin and weakened as he'd become in those weeks, was too strong for me. His steel hands grabbed at my wrists and peeled them away from Khalid. Mahmud and Suleiman helped him to hold me back as I struggled and reached out to grab Khalid's jacket. And then we watched him walk from the camp into the winter that one way or another had ruined or killed us all.
Didn't you see it? Mahmud asked me when he was gone. Didn't you see his face?
Yes, I saw it. I saw it,
I sobbed, staggering back to the cave to fall into the crumpled cell of my misery. I lay there for hours, unsleeping, filthy, starving, angry and broken-hearted. And I might have died there. Some pain sometimes leaves you without legs or arms, but the smell of food brought me round. The men had decided that they couldn't wait to cook the last of the rotting meat. They'd boiled it in a pot during those hours, fanning the smoke away continuously and concealing the flame with blankets. The soup was ready long before dawn, and every man took a bowl, glass, or mug of it. The stink of the rotting meat was more than our empty stomachs could bear at first. We all vomited the foul, retching sips we took. But hunger has a will of its own, a will that's much older than the other will we praise and flatter in the palace of the mind. We were too hungry to refuse the food, and by the third try, or the fifth for some of us, we kept the repulsive, stinking brew down. Then the pain caused by the hot soup in our empty stomachs was as sharp as a belly full of fish hooks. Yet that too passed, and every man forced himself to drink three helpings and to chew the rubbery, rotting chunks of meat. For 2 hours after that, we took turns to dash into the rocks as the food worked through intestines and bowels that had seized in our starving bodies and suddenly erupted. At last, when we recovered, and when all the prayers were said, and when each man was ready, we gathered near the southeastern edge of the compound, at the place Habib had recommended for our attack. He'd assured us that the steep slope was our one chance to fight our way to freedom. And since he'd planned to fight in the attack with us, we had no reason to distrust the advice. We were six men. The five others were Suleiman, Mahmud Melbaf, Nazir, Jalalad, and young Alauddin. He was a shy man of 20, with a boy's grin beneath an old man's faded green eyes. He caught my eye and nodded encouragingly. I returned the nod with a smile, and his face broke into a wider grin while his head nodded more vigorously. I looked away, ashamed that I'd spent so much time with him, months of hard time,
without once trying to engage him in a conversation. We were